My name is Ryan Owens, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, John Piatti. Please join me in thanking our musicians today, Folk Soul. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding, world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. As many of you know, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum programs are recorded for New Hampshire Public Radio. Today's talk may be heard on NHPR two Sundays from now at 10 p.m. The talk will also be available on our website, monadnocklyceum.org, as a podcast within a few days. After the presentation, in keeping with the Lyceum tradition, the speaker has agreed to answer questions from the audience. The ushers will be collecting your questions toward the end of the talk. Please write them on the yellow cards provided. Following the program, we invite you to attend an informal reception in the parish hall, which is through the door to your left. There, you will have the opportunity to engage in further conversation with our speaker and to enjoy refreshments. As you entered this morning, in your pew, you will find a blue card. We hope you will give us feedback on today's program and join our mailing list and/or email list. You can either mail the blue card to us or drop it in one of the glass bowls here in the church or in the parish hall. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in the same glass bowls here or in the parish hall. Thank you for your generous support. Our speaker today is John Piatti. John and I share a profession in common, and that is that we're both in the land conservation business. But John started conserving land first, which is why he holds a special place in my mind. You see, John was the guy with the courage to try first all the craziest farmland protection schemes that the rest of us were too constrained by convention to try. And he succeeded. John has worked at the forefront of sustainable agriculture in his home state of Maine since the early 1990s, when he created the Maine Farms Project. He later helped found Maine Farmland Trust, becoming its president in 2006. Under his leadership, MFT supported 500 farm families and protected 50,000 acres of farmland. In July 2016, John became the fifth president of American Farmland Trust, the pioneering national organization that, since 1980, has helped permanently protect 5 million acres of farmland and helped farmers adopt environmentally sound farming practices on millions more. Right now, land conservation trusts, including mine, the Monadnock Conservancy, are elevating the priority of farmland in our conservation planning. And as soon as we began to encounter the unique challenges of farmland protection, I began asking myself, what would the Maine Farmland Trust do? And I was so serious in my pursuit of John's example that in 2014, I hired one of his former employees when she decided to move to New Hampshire. What John and MFT realized early on is that a farm without a farmer is just land. That is to say, in farmland protection, if all you do is prevent the land from being developed, then you haven't done enough. If you want to see the soil nurtured and food grown, if you want the place to be more than another hobby farm or country estate, then you need to place a farmer on that land, or help to keep one who is already there. Unfortunately, it has never been more difficult for new farmers to gain affordable access to productive land, or for existing farmers to stay in business. But in these challenges lies John's strength and persistence, and as such, he brings hope for the future. John?
Thanks, Ryan. It's a real pleasure to be here today. I always enjoy the opportunity to talk about farming and food, especially to a group that is clearly committed to a more sustainable future. And it's a real honor to have the opportunity to speak in this beautiful and historic setting. I've given many talks over the years, but I can only think of one other occasion that I've had to make a speech in such an iconic venue for discourse and learning. I grew up on Nantucket Island, a point I'll return to later. And 2 years ago, I had the opportunity to speak at the Nantucket Athenaeum, the glorious Greek Revival library that was built during the island's heyday. There I was speaking not only in the same chamber, but most likely at the same lectern that Ralph Waldo Emerson and William Lloyd Garrison and Frederick Douglass had spoken. Douglass, in fact, made many speeches at the Athenaeum in the 1840s and 50s when Nantucket Quakers were playing a leading role in the abolitionist movement. Now, I'm not one who's adept at social media, but during that talk, I did ask my wife, Susan, to take a photo of me and send it to my office so we could post it on the website with a caption saying, "I'm so honored to be speaking where Frederick Douglass spoke." Of course, I was assuming that everyone who would know who Frederick Douglass was. How silly of me. Clearly, I wasn't envisioning the election of Donald Trump. Anyway, I thought this group might get that illusion, and I promise that will be my one and only political jab. I think it's particularly fitting to be talking about food and farming in a setting like this one, which has over the years encouraged dialogue and action around the central moral issues of the day, including abolition and women's suffrage. And I say that because I believe that the health of our planet is the moral issue of our day. And more ever, that we cannot hope for a healthy environment or a sustainable future if we don't get farming right. Today I'm going to talk a bit about farming in New England, and then a bit about farming across the country, and then about the organization I now run. And then I'm finally going to talk a bit about your role, which is indeed an important role in the future of farming. But let me start by describing how I found my way to these issues. I told you I grew up on Nantucket Island, which is true, but as a young boy, I lived in suburban Boston. My world was shattered quite suddenly when my father was killed, and my mother, seeking escapism, packed up the family and moved us to Nantucket, where the family had recently enjoyed a summer vacation full of good memories. My years on the island healed me and shaped me. My mother remarried a seventh generation islander who taught me how to hunt and fish, and who tended a large garden from which my mother put up all of our vegetables for the winter. Nantucket's natural beauty and an engaging teacher inspired me to become a student of ecology, and I took to exploring the island's fields and woods and marshlands. Meanwhile, I had become part of a close-knit island community. Nantucket then was different than today. No place stays the same, but Nantucket went through some profound changes in the years since I graduated from high school. In the early 1980s sparked a building boom and skyrocketing property values. Almost all of my high school friends came from old island families, but many could not afford to return to the island after a few years of college or in military service. Nor could I go back. By then, my stepfather had passed away and my mother had moved off island, and I had no foothold. But the primary reason, which struck me during a reflective visit to the island between college and graduate school, was that I simply couldn't afford to live there. Why is it that every rural community seems destined to go one of two routes? It either withers away, becoming an economic ghost town, or it becomes hip and overbuilt and overpriced, as my home had done. Either way, there are no opportunities for local people to make a home where they had grown up. I entered graduate school committed to change that. I was going to focus my energies on creating new economic opportunities in rural places, the kind that could allow local folks to stay there if they wanted, sustainable economic development that could occur without spoiling the place. Soon as circumstances allowed, Susan and I moved to Maine, where I began to work with a number of small businesses, but not farms. No, even though I was living in an old farmhouse and had a big garden and put up most of our vegetables for winter, I, like almost everyone else in New England 30 years ago, didn't view farming as having a future. Not here. I soon found myself co-chairing the local comprehensive plan committee with a dairy farmer. And once he had sized me up, as only a farmer can do, and learned that I really wasn't all that bad, he challenged me. "John, you say you care about rural Maine, but you know absolutely nothing about farming." He was right, of course. And I was big enough to admit that. He became the first of many farming mentors. And the more I learned, the more I began to appreciate an undeniable truth that in most parts of Maine, and indeed in much of America, you simply can't hope to bring about sustainable rural development without sustainable agriculture. And with that epiphany, I had found my work. For almost 30 years, my entire professional focus has been on farming, and until last year, as you heard from Ryan, I've done most of that work in the state of Maine. Now, to many people, Maine isn't an agricultural powerhouse, and yet those of us who have focused on Maine agriculture over the last 25 years, just like our colleagues in other New England states, we have seen some impressive results. The U.S. Department of Agriculture conducts a farm census every 5 years, in the years ending with a 2, and the years ending with a 7. The latest data is from 2002. And in the window from 2002 to 2012, the number of farms in Maine grew by over 1,000, up 14%. True, many of these were small farms, but overall the acres in production grew by 8%. And the overall economic activity of Maine farms soared. At the same time, we were seeing increases in the number of young people interested in farming. Between 2007 and 2012, Maine saw a staggering 40% increase in beginning farmers, leading the nation. I could go on and on with fascinating statistics, but let me get to the summary, which is that farming in Maine, and indeed all across New England, although Maine and Vermont have led the pack, farming here has boomed in the last 15 years. Just about everyone and their mother now seems to be excited about local food. Interest in farmers markets and CSAs have soared. So many restaurants, including some chains, now build menus around local ingredients. And yet, the growth has not been uniform. Far from it. At the same time that some farms are growing, others are struggling. At the same time that many new farms and food businesses are being created, a lot of long-held family farms are going out of business. So what's happening? I'm going to give you an answer. It's an incomplete answer because we have minutes, not hours. The details more complicated and nuanced, but the summary is helpful. It will give you a sense. You can summarize what's been happening with farming in New England over the last generation as a bifurcation. Farming has gone down two different paths. One path is what we generally often think of as a farm. It has big open fields and big big barns and tractors, and here it has animals, cows usually. Indeed, in New England, our primary agricultural production in the last half of the 20th century has been dairy. New England has also retained some fairly good-sized orchards and farms that grow specialized products like cranberries in southeastern Massachusetts and potatoes in northern Maine. If you take all of those products together, that has made up the bulk of New England's agricultural output until recently. And these farms aren't necessarily big. The absolute biggest, our biggest dairy farms or biggest potato farms might be 1,500 acres. That's small by national standards, and most of our farms are much smaller than that. What places all of these farms in one category is not their size, but that the farmers sell their products as commodities in bulk to either a processor or a wholesaler. That's one path, and I'll refer to that as commodity agriculture. The other path has gone by different names over the last 25 years, but the term that's usually applied now is local agriculture. These farms may be growing the same products as commodity farms, though sometimes they're more diversified. Sometimes they're smaller than commodity farms, but not always. They may be organic, but not necessarily. The key difference is not in what they grow, or their size, or their farming practices. The key difference is in how they market. These farms are selling direct or close to direct. Direct meaning through a farm stand, or a farmer's market, or a CSA. Close to direct meaning to a local store, or to a local restaurant that retains the connection to that farm. Almost all of the growth in agriculture which has occurred in the last 25 years has been in the second path. In fact, a fair summary of farming in New England over the last generation would be to say that we kept some farms alive and indeed have allowed some farms to thrive by marketing more direct, highlighting quality and freshness and a link to that label local. Now, it's easy to take all this information and jump to a conclusion that isn't necessarily right. It's easy to see that second path, local agriculture, as exciting and hip in the future, and to see that first path of commodity agriculture as being tired and old and bound to disappear and that maybe it should. But don't jump to that conclusion, because the truth is far more complicated. The truth is that the two paths are interwoven, and I'll give you two examples. Let's take a young couple who have a small herd of goats and is making a really good chèvre that they're selling at the local farmer's market, maybe to a couple of restaurants. They're not making a lot of money, but they're living the life they want, and they're doing all right. But the only reason their numbers work at all is because they can buy grain for their goats in bulk. And they can only do that because they're living in a community that still has commodity dairy farms and the infrastructure that goes with that, the grain storage, the equipment dealer, the large animal vet. Now let's take a potato farmer in northern Maine. He grows 400 acres of potatoes, selling them to the McCain's plant down the street that turns them into French fries, primarily for McDonald's. Let's use this example to make two points. First, I want to rebuff the idea that this farmer has many options. He quite simply is not in a position to sell all of his products locally. 400 acres is not a large farm, but 400 acres of potato fields grows about 10 million pounds of potatoes in a year. That's more potatoes than are consumed by everyone who lives within 100 miles of this farm, and there's 100 other farms around him that are doing the same thing. So local sales, direct marketing, is really not an option. But farmers are smart, and there's no doubt that commodity farmers are seeing what's happened with local agriculture and are making adjustments where they can. I know of more than one northern Maine potato farm which continues to sell the bulk of their production to a processor, but which at the same time is experimenting with small acreage of heirloom variety potatoes, which they sell through a broker to East Coast restaurants. So these two paths are interconnected. There's been a lot of talk about how New England might serve more of its own food needs. I played a small role in a study released in 2015, some of you may have heard of it, called A New England Food Vision. It generated a lot of attention in the last 2 years. The study outlines how our region might grow half of all of our food, up from less than 10% now, by the year 2060. The study looked at the availability of land, it looked at dietary trends and soil types and population growth. It was comprehensive. And that 50% goal is achievable and would bring with it many environmental and economic benefits. But the only way that will ever happen is if New England has more land in production. If we retain most of our larger farms and scale up some of our smaller ones. The Food Vision appreciates the value of farms of all sizes growing a variety of product, but at the same time, it recognizes that certain products, including livestock and grains and some vegetables, require a certain scale. In farming circles, you'll hear conversations about ag in the middle. Farms that retain some of the best benefits of local agriculture, including quality and freshness, and the fact that more of the benefits flow back to the farmer rather than a middleman, while at the same time scaling up enough to see some economies of scale and to access some new or broader markets. It's great that there's been such growth in farmers markets and CSAs and white tablecloth restaurants that promote local products. Indeed, I've spent much of my career trying to make that happen. But at the same time, it's unrealistic to think that the majority of people will get the majority of their food through a CSA. Most of us will get our food at the supermarket, or depending on our circumstances, maybe through an institution like a school or a nursing home or a workplace cafeteria. If we are serious about New England providing half of our food needs, we will need a diverse array of farms of many sizes and many scales. And we will also have to do an awful lot more so we don't lose any more farmland. I haven't yet talked about farmland, but the land resource is clearly critical. It's the underlying resource and infrastructure upon which everything in farming depends. And there's a limited supply that is disappearing. In America, we lose 40 acres of good farmland every hour. That's 350,000 acres a year. Sadly, there are many people within agriculture who don't quite get the land side, the need for farmland protection. They feel that there are good markets for farmland products. The market will take care of itself. They're wrong. I could give you a lot of information on this topic. I don't have the time right now. I just want to give you a little sense of the importance of farmland protection. We use the term farmland protection to talk about restricting what you can do on a property through a deed with a vehicle called an agricultural conservation easement, or an ag easement. This will support farming in different activities for farming, but restrict non-agricultural development. Now, agricultural easements are different from standard conservation easements. And the difference stems from a different purpose. I'm simplifying here, but I think this will be useful. The classic conservation easement, the one that protects that beautiful piece of woodland at the edge of town that people love to hike on Sundays and that is scenic and is full of wildlife, that easement, in essence, is designed to keep the land the way it is. But an agricultural easement is designed with a different purpose: to make sure that that land is always available for farming. As such, agricultural easements have to come with a lot of flexibility. You may need to build a new barn where there's a field. You may need to clear some woodlands for a new pasture. You may need a new house for the next generation of farmers. And to some degree, most agricultural easements allow for these kind of developments that support farms. Why are agricultural easements important? Well, to farm, you need land. And although more and more farmers are looking at leasing, and that's great, the vast amount of farmland is still owned by farmers, and that's generally good, because the landowner has the best incentive to make sure the long-term practices on that land are sustainable. Now, if a farmer needs to buy a piece of land, she basically has to pay a developer's price for land that she never wants to see developed. It's kind of odd if you think about it. A farmer has to pay for a value that she doesn't want to realize and will never realize as long as she farms the land. And this distorts the economics of farming. But when an easement is placed on a piece of farmland, everything changes. Farmland with an easement on it doesn't sell at its development value because it can't be turned into house lots or the next Walmart. Rather, it sells for what we call its farmland value, set by the market for what a farmer can make on that land by farming it. Now the economics make sense. What this means is that farmland that's protected sells at a lower price. And given that the price of farmland is the primary barrier that's preventing young people from entering the field, this is often necessary for the future of farming. Protecting farmland is also incredibly important for existing farmers, who often have a lot of equity tied up in their land, but no way to access that value. But farmers can sell an easement on their property. 30 states now have some kind of a program for selling easements, thanks to the organization that I now run, American Farmland Trust, that helped create many of these programs. And if a farmer sells the easement, this immediately has a positive impact on the farmer's finances, because it either gets used to pay down the debt or to reinvest in farm innovation. So protecting farmland has both a direct bearing on attracting new farmers and on helping existing farms be economically viable. This is perhaps a little bit too technical, but hopefully I'm helping you see that there's a lot that's needed if we're going to move towards a more healthy and robust and environmentally sustainable food system. It's not just about one thing. It's about many things that are interconnected. And that's a great segue to talk about American Farmland Trust. I've been leading AFT for just a year, but I've been familiar with AFT for my whole time in this field, and that's natural, because AFT, more than any other organization, has advanced conservation agriculture. Beyond this, we turned to AFT 20 years ago in Maine when some of us were concerned about the loss of farmland. We turned to them, and the result was the creation of Maine Farmland Trust, the organization I ultimately ran. Despite the similarity of names, there's no connection between the two groups. We Mainers simply reached out to AFT, and we thanked them by stealing a lot of their good ideas and two-thirds of their name. American Farmland Trust has an interesting story. It was founded by the late Peggy Rockefeller, wife of David Rockefeller, who just passed away this spring at age 101. Peggy was passionate about farming, overseeing family operations in both the Hudson Valley and in Maine. In the 1970s, Peggy served on the board of the Nature Conservancy, and she asked why some of the new tools that were being developed for land conservation couldn't be applied to farms. And she was told that by TNC that they didn't do that. Being Peggy Rockefeller, she then created an organization that would. Back in 1980, when AFT was chartered, there was no federal legislation to allow for conservation easements, no private agricultural land trusts, and no state programs that protected farmland. AFT helped create it all. And in the process, as you've learned, the organization has helped protect over 5 million acres of farmland. That's quite a legacy, but it doesn't stop there. From almost the beginning, AFT realized that it wasn't enough to just place agricultural easements on farmland. That if the purpose of protecting farmland was to make sure that that land would forever be available for agriculture, then you also had to worry about farming practices. Simply put, if the farming practices resulted in losing topsoil or other long-term deterioration, that land would not be there forever to serve farming. In addition, farmland, even if protected with an easement, would not continue to be farmed if there were no farmers who could make a living on it. So AFT developed a comprehensive and holistic vision designed around saving the land that sustains us through three interconnected strategies: protecting farmland with easements, promoting environmentally sound farming practices, and keeping farmers on the land. I've already talked about protecting farmland with easements. The second leg of our stool, AFT's focused on environmentally sound farming practices, is a major part of what we do. In the interest of time, I'm just going to touch on two initiatives. First, what we call our Best Management Practices Challenge. Many farmers are apprehensive about adopting more environmentally sound farming practices because they fear that doing so might affect their production, even put them out of business. AFT has taken the bold step of assuring farmers who follow certain farming practices that we will cover their costs if that happens. To date, payouts have been rare and low. But the fact that we're there has emboldened many farmers to take this step. It's a great program. We need to do more of it. Second, I want to call your attention to farming's opportunity to combat climate change. Few people know it, but about half of the carbon that has been released into our atmosphere since the dawn of the Industrial Revolution has not come from burning fossil fuels, but has been released from our soil by poor farming practices. By rebuilding soil health through better farming practices, no-till and better rotations and better use of cover crops and more, we can return much of that carbon to the earth. Carbon farming, as this set of practices increasingly is known, could be an important part of reducing atmospheric carbon. And AFT has been working and leading this area for close to 15 years. The third leg of our stool, keeping farmers on the land, no less important than the other two. And AFT addresses this with a number of programs to help next generation farmers and a number of programs to help farmers be economically viable. Now, perhaps it's all now getting pretty clear that these three legs are interconnected, and at best, synergistic. AFT is the only national organization working on this issue in this manner, taking this kind of a holistic approach. We're unique in another way as well. We are both an agricultural organization and an environmental organization. We see great benefit to having a foot squarely in each camp. Creates challenges at times, but it also allows us to bring different groups together and at best to earn respect from both communities. We have a highly diverse board that reflects a full spectrum of opinions, as you can well imagine, both with environmental issues and with farming issues. But for the past 37 years, and I hope for the foreseeable future, we've been able to sort of ignore the din and focus on common ground solutions. It's becoming harder and harder to work in this way, given the increasingly polarized nature of our society and our discourse. Beyond this, as an organization that needs to do much more and could use more resources to do that, it hurts at times to stay the course when we see other farm and environmental organizations taking advantage of this polarization to raise funds. But AFT is committed to this difficult yet critically important approach, what we sometimes refer to as our commitment to the radical center. Now, I'm saying a lot of great things about the organization I work for, and it sounds like we have our act together, and that's not completely true. First, we have done some really amazing things in the last 37 years, but we realize that the challenges of the future, the challenges that lay ahead, mean that we have to significantly step up our game. It's great that we've protected 5 million acres of farmland. That is about one half of 1% of the farmland in America. How great that we've been leaders in environmentally sound farming practices, including practices that can help combat climate change. But boy, do we need to do this at a whole other scale and do it soon. And how great that we're helping next generation farmers and existing farmers be successful. But with the average age of farmers now at roughly 60, and with the ownership of 370 million acres of American farmland likely to change hands in the next 10 to 20 years due simply to demographic factors, we need to do so much more. Beyond these challenges, there's another one. And that's simply that AFT has a major awareness deficiency. I describe AFT as the least known organization doing some of the most important work in this country. Some people know our bumper sticker, no farms, no food, but generally only insiders in the agriculture and the conservation community really know our name, let alone the complex and important work that we do. It's odd in a way. AFT was the pioneer, the initial force behind agricultural conservation, which led to both farmland protection and to this resurgence in local agriculture. And yet, during the last 10 years or so, during the time that this wave of interest in local food has just, it's everywhere, AFT has simply plugged away at its critically important but relatively unknown work. We know we need to change that. We know we need to elevate public awareness of what we do. And not just because we have a teenager's interest in being popular. It's because we realize that the work that needs to be done is so great, and that it can never be done without far more allies, partners, and supporters. And that's where you come in. I've told my board that what AFT really needs is a barely restrained mob of people who are demanding that we do what's right by agriculture. We currently have 40,000 members. We need 1 million or more. There's 321 million people living in this country. That's 321 million people who rely on our farmland for their very sustenance. I think we need to get at least one out of every 321 of them to actively support the work of AFT, other land trusts, other farm groups, and all of the farmers in this nation who sustain us. I sometimes think that what we really need to build the food system that's going to be necessary for a sustainable future, what we really need is just more people who appreciate farming, both its challenges and its opportunities, not on a superficial level, but on a deep level. As a society, we're now a couple of generations removed from a farm. And so that knowledge has really waned. It's great to see the renewed interest in people and food and farm issues from reading Michael Pollan and people getting interested in federal farm policy and the like. That's wonderful. It's the right direction. But we need to intensify that and we need to deepen that and make sure people are really understanding both the opportunities and the challenges for American agriculture. Simply put, we need more people who care deeply about these issues, which truly are the central issues of our day, the central moral issues of our day. If we don't get farming right, we have no chance for a sustainable future. Please join me in this noble cause. I thank you.